Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I am going to talk about chaos in the student loan servicing world and what it means for your bottom line, your life, your anxiety levels, and your future annoyances that you're going to have to deal with, if any. So there's a lot of stuff going on. We're going to talk in detail about it. A lot of this is going to be speculation on my part, okay? So I'm just going to tell you when I know something, and I'm going to tell you when I think something, just so that you can know the difference and so you can kind of get an idea of what to expect. However, first, we're going to answer a couple of listener questions, which I love getting. So if you want to ask a question, you can obviously hire us and we can do the 1 hour custom plan, or you can also ask if it's a quick 30 second question, you can ask that for free here on the podcast. To do that, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail is where you need to go and just press the record button when you're at that URL on your Android or iPhone or whatever you're using, and then just record a quick little 30 second to minute question and we'll answer it on the show if we think it's a good one. So first question comes from Marshall about a change in income in his family.
Hey, Travis, thanks so much for taking my question. First, thank you so much to you and your team for all the information and hard work you guys have put out the past several years. It's been extremely helpful. I just had a quick question. I'm an academic physician about 2 years away from public service loan forgiveness, currently repaying under IBR because of a loans taken out before 2007. I file separately with my wife, who is currently a W-2 employee, but is planning on transitioning to be a 1099 employee, likely with a pretty substantial loss in income, at least for the first couple of years. I was wondering what kind of considerations we should have regarding my student loan structure in that transition. Just for context, we do not live in a community property state. Look forward to hearing any input you have on this. Thanks, Travis, and have a great day.
Interesting question. For those of you, for the uninitiated, I guess you could say, people that have loans from before October the 1st, 2007 are not eligible for this program called Pay As You Earn. Pay As You Earn is 10% of your income. If you file jointly, it's 10% of your household income. If you file separate, then it's just 10% of only your income as the borrower. Now, in some cases, especially cases where someone's income is pretty similar, you know, if you're not eligible for Pay As You Earn because you took out loans from before October 2007, then it might make sense for you to pay 15% of your income on the income-based repayment plan, the IBR plan. IBR is 15% of your income. If you're filing jointly for taxes, obviously the repay plan is probably going to be better. The reason it's probably going to be better is because 10% of your income with revised Pay As You Earn is lower than 15% of your income with income-based repayment, which is one of the older student loan income-based programs. Now, one exception is when your income is way higher than your debt. If your income is way higher than your debt, what a lot of times will happen is initially you'll be on an IBR plan making payments based on your income, but then you'll no longer qualify because your income becomes too high relative to your debt. And technically, the phrase no longer qualify is actually not correct. That's what the servicers will tell you. They'll tell you, sorry, you don't qualify anymore. What they really mean is that you're no longer able to pay based on your income because your payment is capped at the standard 10-year plan. So let me just give you an example before I address Marshall's question specifically. If you have, say, $100,000 of student loans and you're a physician making $200,000, well, in residency, you might be paying $400 or $500 a month on the IBR plan. But then when you become an attending, 15% of $200,000 is quite a bit of money. That might cause you to pay off your $100,000 rapidly within a few years, and then you'd have nothing left to forgive. Therein lies the mistake, because on the income-based repayment, what you'll have happen is your payment will get capped at the standard 10-year plan, which if you're on IBR for $100,000 with a $200,000 income, that's going to be about 1% of what you owe. So that's about $1,000 a month. So if you could get that payment capped, even for a few years, if it's capped, then you're still going to have a substantial amount left over to be forgiven. So not every PSLF case is, oh, I owe way more than what I earn. I have so much debt. And, you know, I have to get PSLF or else. There's a lot of PSLF cases out there where someone owes less than what they earn, and they just don't know and don't understand these rules around capped payments on the income-based repayment and the pay-as-you-earn plan. So for this listener's question in particular, he's saying that his wife's income is going to go way down, okay? And also going from W-2, she's going from W-2 to 1099. So right away, what my question is this. So think about kind of the math of everything. So let's say that you have one spouse making $100,000, one making $50,000. In that case, 15% of 100,000 should be equal to 10% of 100,000 plus 50,000. So in other words, 10% of $150,000 household income is about the same thing as 15% of 100,000 of just the primary borrower's income, right? So what that means is if the person who has the loans, in this case, the listener that asked the question, if this new income change is going to result in the primary borrower having basically income that is at least two times that of their spouse, now that their spouse has got a lower income, then you probably would want to consider switching from income-based repayment to revised pay-as-you-earn. And the reason is that would just give you a lower monthly payment and take away the complexity of having to file taxes separately. If you live in a community property state, that's more complicated. So if you live in a community property state like, you know, California, Texas, Arizona, or you know, Washington state, there's a few of them. There's nine of them in total. Then you might want to actually continue filing separately, especially if your income is significantly higher than that of your spouse. But in a regular state like a New York or a Florida or North Carolina or Illinois or Missouri or some non-community property state, then that's kind of the rule of thumb that I like to use. If you're anywhere around that situation where the person who has the student loan debt is got an income of at least two times that of the lower earning spouse, then you might want to consider switching from income-based repayment to revised pay-as-you-earn. The way you do that is you make a one-time $5 payment, that'll allow you to swap from income-based repayment to revised pay-as-you-earn. You don't lose any credit towards PSLF. You maintain all the credit that you have. And the payment count just stays the same. It doesn't drop or change. The worst thing that can happen really is, you know, you can have your interest capitalized, which if you're going for loan forgiveness, doesn't matter. And then the other thing that can happen is maybe that was the right decision for like a year, but what if you're in this scenario where, you know, you have a lot higher income than you do debt? Well, then the income-based repayment program would have been much better because you would have been able to stick to that and get your payment capped. In this case, our listener only has 2 years left to go on PSLF. So I would prioritize completely, how do you minimize the payments to get the payments as low as possible? That's a great question. A lot of complexities going on there. Also, since his wife is a 1099, 1099s have way more opportunities to lower taxable income than W-2s do. W-2s are only able to do basically $19,500 into your 401k if you have one. A lot of people don't. And then also maybe a health savings account, which is about $7,000 for a family. But besides that, you can't really do anything. Whereas with a 1099, you can do SEP IRAs, you can do solo 401ks, which allow you to put away a lot more money for taxes. Then you could really get that income for the spouse low enough to potentially just do the repay plan and get a lower payment overall and not have to worry about filing taxes separately anymore. And then you can do your own taxes and save some money on that as well and not have to pay any tax penalties. So a lot of jam-packed stuff in that question. Thank you so much for asking it. And now a question from a listener about what happens to your credit score after a loan forgiveness happens.
Hey, Travis. Wanted to know what the student loan forgiveness implications are for your credit. I have future in-laws that think my credit is going to go into the garbage can when my federal student loans get forgiven at the end of the income-based repayment time period. I'd like to have some way to assure them that that won't happen. But I'm not sure if anybody can make those assurances because this hasn't happened yet and won't for another 10 to 15 years. Let me know what you think. Thanks.
Yet another great question. So there's five factors determining your FICO score, your credit score. First is your payment history. Second is how much debt you have relative to your available credit. Three is how long you've had your accounts, your credit or loan accounts. Four is your mix of different types of credit, basically whatever kinds of accounts you have. And then five is your appetite for new credit. So here's some things that affect your credit score. Your payment history. How much are you on time? Do you have a bunch of late payments? Have you defaulted? That's very important, making on-time payments. Next is how much debt you have relative to what your credit limit is. So for example, there's something called utilization ratio. What that does is it basically looks, say you have $20,000 of credit on your credit card limit, but you only spend an average of $2,000 or $3,000 a month. That's a really, really good usage of debt because you're using a very small percentage of what your available credit limit is. So that's a really good sign to a lender. Next is how long you've had accounts. You hear some people say, well, you need to make sure you don't cancel your oldest credit card. I'll tell you right away that I've canceled two of my oldest credit cards, because at the end of the day, your credit score doesn't have to be 850, which, you know, you don't have to have a perfect credit score. You just have to have something that's decent. You don't need to have a spotless credit score. In fact, if you have a perfect credit score, that's probably a bad thing, because it probably means you focus so much on your credit score, which, you know, you only really need a good one if you're trying to buy something with credit versus focusing on your net worth. That's not ideal, right? You not want to just arbitrarily cancel, you know, an old card, you know, but especially if you enjoy using it, but don't worry about that too much. So the next one is different kinds of loans that you have. So the, you know, student loans, car loans, credit cards, home mortgage, whatever. I mean, the fact that you have multiple different kinds is kind of a positive. And then also how many times, this is number five, appetite for new credit. That's kind of like, are you applying for a bunch of different cards? That's not necessarily a good thing. Like if they, somebody sees you applying to 20 different places, that can be a negative to your credit, because it's assuming you're desperate, I guess, and just trying to apply a lot of places. So I got a couple of those from this site, rate.com. If you think about all of those components, nowhere in there is listed, you know, what happens when your student loans are forgiven, right? So in other words, there's nothing clear about a credit score that would say that if you have a mass forgiveness event on your student loan debt, that that's going to negatively impact your credit score. There's nothing you can point to say that. So there's zero evidence that your credit score is negatively impacted by student loan forgiveness. If you are to say, well, prove that it won't be, well, I can't really do that necessarily, because, I mean, theoretically, they could write a specific rule that says that it is negatively impacted. So I can't prove 100% that there would be no impact, even though I'm almost certain there will be no impact. And here's why. We had this situation with Great Lakes where millions of people's credit scores were negatively impacted because they reported a forbearance the wrong way with this COVID forbearance. And that hurt a lot of people's credit scores, and people were upset about it. But Great Lakes went in and corrected it. They contacted all the servicers and got that fixed. Now, the thing is we're going to have millions of people pursuing forgiveness, right? So there's over 3 million people with six figures of student loan debt. I would wager the majority of those are going to be going for forgiveness, either PSLF or in the private sector. That number, by the way, doubles. Historically, the number of borrowers with six figures of student loans has been doubling approximately every like 3 to 5 years. So if you fast forward to 20 years from now, you could easily see a situation where you could have 5 to 10 times. I mean, it really depends on how fast that rate of doubling changes, but you could have 5 to 10 times the number of people with six figures of student loan debt that are dealing with loan forgiveness at the point where everybody would be worrying about it. So say you have 10 million people that are trying to pursue loan forgiveness. In that case, you're not going to affect the credit scores negatively of millions of people with graduate degrees, or you'd crash the economy, because you need those people to go out and buy new cars, buy new houses, buy a new boat, right? The American economy is built on the back of consumerism, and that's sort of your jumbo consumers, right? It's people that have high educations and high incomes. So it would be really against any financial institution's best interest to affect someone's credit score negatively because they're going for loan forgiveness. So I would not worry about this. There's a whole lot of things in the world that I would worry about, way, way more than credit score, just period. But once you've kind of looked over the rules, I think it's pretty clear that student loan forgiveness is not going to affect your credit score. Now, as promised, let's talk about the main event. Let's talk about the coming student loan servicer chaos. First off, let me just explain what's going on, because a lot of people are thinking, what do you mean chaos? Here's how all this stuff works. Back in the day, the government made student loan guarantees, but not student loans as much directly as they do now. Basically, the typical way that the government got involved in student loans prior to 2010 was that they would guarantee student loans, and then private banks would go out there and make the loans. But the government would stand behind that. So that's kind of like the way we do mortgages in America. It's kind of like that Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, government guaranteed mortgage kind of thing. So you're not getting a mortgage directly from the United States government. You're getting a mortgage indirectly from the United States government because it's guaranteeing it. So with the student loan system, that's kind of how it functioned. The student loan world was sort of guaranteed by the government, but there were these banks that actually made the loans. Now, what happened in 2010 is we already had some level of direct student loans that were out there. The Obama administration basically said, you know what, the 2008 financial crisis is showing that banks should not be involved in the student loan servicer game in a big way, and we should end the guaranteed, you know, federal student loan system. So that was ended, and that's when the direct student loan system became the you know, method of default issuance for student loans in the United States are pretty much everything. So that's why the FFEL program ended and the direct loan program really started in earnest in 2010 for the most part. The problem is the government is not the kind of place where you're going to hire thousands of people to run a call center. There's a lot of reasons for that. One reason is it's kind of expensive to hire federal employees. They get really good benefits. They get pensions. They get great retirement benefits and paid time off. So there's a rational argument to be made. If the federal government wants to minimize costs, you're going to outsource that. And who do they outsource it to? They outsource the management of the student loans owned by the federal government to private companies. So one kind of interesting thing is if you think about debt that you have, it's a liability, right? But to the people that own the debt, it's an asset. And so the government actually, the largest asset the government owns, I've heard, is federal student loans because it's the largest investment that they hold. This is not looking at the Fed, that's kind of separate. But like we're talking just like the US government fiscally itself, that's a huge asset that it owns. And it basically hires companies, private companies, to manage the payment of and servicing of these loans because the federal government is not going to hire a bazillion people to do this directly. And so in the 2009, 2010 kind of era, they picked the current four big platforms and they have, I think, nine total servicers. If I read off all of the servicers, you might recognize some of them. So there's the for-profit servicers and there's the not-for-profit servicers, but the big four are FedLoan, Great Lakes, Navient, and Nelnet. And then there's ECSI, which is the one that manages a lot of the Department of Health student loans. There's the Default Resolution Group, which is Maximus Federal Services. There's OSLA Servicing. There's Mohila, Ed Financial, Granite State, and Cornerstone. So those are that's all the servicers that exist out there. But the big four, where the vast majority of people have their loans, are FedLoan, Great Lakes, Navient, and Nelnet. That's the big four. So I would say 95% of our clients and readers have accounts at those four places if they have federal loans. Now, the new servicers, so these contracts are roughly for like 10 years. And so when those contracts are up, whoever's the Department of Education secretary can basically negotiate the terms of the new contract, right? The new long-term contract for the Department of Education for who's going to manage this super important, gigantic loan portfolio that the federal government owns for student loans. And so the Department of Education secretary is currently Betsy DeVos, who's a Trump appointee. And so she signed a contract. It's already signed. So the question is whether or not this contract could be enforced if they were to lose the election or not. So this contract's already signed with five new servicers, and she effectively fired the four existing student loan servicers. So FedLoan, Navient, Nelnet, and Great Lakes have basically been fired by the Department of Education starting December 14th, 2020. Now, this contract that they have allows the Department of Education to extend their student loan servicing with these companies two times for a six-month period each. So that's what the Department of Education can do. It has the option to do that. But Betsy DeVos has said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go forward, move forward with these five new companies. So this is going to create a gigantic mess. And I think that this is going to be a disaster personally, at least in the short run. Long term, I guess theoretically they could figure it out, but this is going to be a giant mess is what my opinion is. And let me say this, we're talking about a lot of companies. There's a lot of money at stake. I'm sure maybe some of them would be interested in being litigious with me. So let me just say that this podcast is my own personal opinion. So everything I'm saying in this podcast is my own personal opinion. It's not a statement of fact. So here's my opinion. These five new companies are being hired. They are Mohila, which is Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority. There's Ed Financial, which is a Tennessee company. And I think both of those companies are not-for-profit. There's the Texas Guaranteed Student Loan Corporation, which is called Trellis Company. So they're, I believe, a not-for-profit. And then there's Maximus Federal Services, which kind of does business as this default resolution group for the Department of Ed. They're the servicer for defaulted federal loans. And then there's also FH Con. So Mohila, Ed Financial, Trellis, Maximus, and FH Con. Kind of sounds like a bad Gladiator movie, right? Like Gladiator 2, The Purge. That's what all of these new servicers sound like to me, I guess. So what do I think of these servicers? Well, here's the thing. So the existing servicers, I mean, each of them handles hundreds of billions of dollars of student loan debt. tens of millions of accounts in some cases, or over 10 million accounts. So I think, I'm not sure because I couldn't find the numbers for Ed Financial, but I think that Mohila services 2.9 million borrowers with $69 billion in student debt. So that is large, but it is actually puny compared to the big four. So if you look at the Mohila website, leaves a lot to be desired. I've gotten actually lower ratings for Mohila compared to some other servicers out there. So the Ed Financial Mohila companies, people that have them give them lower marks than the existing big four servicers in a lot of cases, at least for the certainly lower than the top rated servicers. So that's concerning. So you're kind of hiring these sort of very unknown quantities as to be your primary servicers, because this is my guess. So my guess is you're going to have a big three of servicing. I think you're going to have Mohila, Trellis, and Ed Financial. So I think you're going to have go from a big four to a big three. And my guess, I can't say this for sure, but my guess is that Maximus and FH Con are going to focus on the default side of things. So the reason I think that is because Maximus Federal Services is already doing that for the Department of Education. They're the servicer for defaulted student loans. And if you want to talk about somebody that should be fired, I mean, have they managed the default problem well? I guess you could argue that, well, they're getting people in default sent to them, so that's not their fault because they're getting people that are failures of other servicers, basically, that they didn't service those customers adequately. That's why they ended up in default. Maybe you can make that argument. But I sure as heck haven't heard good stories about people getting out of default. We get massive numbers of emails from people that are in default that are struggling, that just have no idea what to do and how to get their problem fixed. So to me, that tells me that why would they be rehired? But they were rehired. So what do I know? I looked at FH Con, that's the fifth company, and oh my gosh, 1997 called and they want their website back. I mean, this is awful. I don't understand how you could hire a company like this looking through their website, because I've never heard of them before. I find no track record for them on student loans at all. Maybe my thinking is that they got included because they, Nelnet and Great Lakes were denied because they didn't quote unquote include small business participation in their bid or something, some weirdo kind of thing. So my guess is like one of those servicers, like maybe included FH Con in the bid or something to try to get extra brownie points to get the contract. I don't know, but I don't really see how this company could manage income-driven repayment plan requests at all. So my guess is they'll be lumped in with Maximus and they'll handle defaults together. And then you'll have Mohila, Ed Financial, and Trellis manage the main servicer accounts. And real talk, so Mohila is a Missouri company. Ed Financial is a Tennessee company. And then Trellis is a Texas company. Anybody holler back red state, red state, red state? I mean, just kind of looking at the ones that were selected. So Mohila is backed by, not backed like financially, but it's supported by the senior senator from the state of Missouri, who's Senator Roy Blunt, who's I think the number three Senate Republican. And then you have Ed Financial. Why is that interesting that they're in Tennessee? The chairman of the Higher Education Committee in the Senate is Lamar Alexander, who is from Tennessee. So that certainly seems like maybe both of those companies might have been chosen from a political nature. And then Texas, I guess, obviously Yeehaw, Texas. I don't know. I mean, again, apologies if anybody's offended over this. I'm just trying to joke around and be a little serious here at the same time. But it certainly seems to me like there's a little bit of a political component to the selection of these servicers, because I don't see any business reasons why you would choose these companies. In fact, Mohila actually uses the software to manage their student loans. They purchased their software from Fed Loan Servicing. They purchase it from FIA, which is the parent company of Fed Loan Servicing, which is just a brand of FIA. And FIA produces this Compass software for servicing, which Mohila uses. That also gives you some clues, because given that Fed Loan currently manages the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, my guess is to minimize disruption, Mohila would take over PSLF. That's just a total, total guess. I have nothing to back that up. It's complete speculation. But that's my guess as to what's going to happen with PSLF, who's going to take that over. And then I feel like probably Ed Financial will take over sort of the Navient role. And then maybe, I guess, Trellis is supposed to be the new Nelnet Great Lakes. I don't know exactly. But I mean, this is just nuts. I mean, it's nuts because you're also in the middle of the most bizarre pause in student loans ever that just was never anticipated before with anybody. How do I know this? Because the banks don't even understand it. I'm getting a lot of emails from readers saying that they're not qualifying for mortgages because generally banks will count what your income-based payment is and they'll use that for determining whether or not you qualify for a mortgage. But the problem is with this national forbearance going on, they're taking basically 1% of the student loan balance and saying that's your required payment. And that's preventing a lot of people with high debt amounts like dentists, veterinarians, lawyers in some cases from qualifying for a mortgage because they treat forbearance as if it's you have to pay 1% of the balance and that makes your debt basically payments too high to get a mortgage. So that's just because they don't understand this corona forbearance that's happening. It's just kind of alien to them. Nobody expected it. Same thing, why did Great Lakes get in trouble for reporting people's credit scores the wrong way? It's because they were not anticipating pausing interest and payments for millions of people all at once. I'm honestly kind of shocked that the servicers have done as well as they have. I'm not saying they've done great by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just saying I was kind of thinking they would fall apart just under the weight of trying to pause everything all at once. But apparently it's seemingly a lot easier to stop interest and stop payment collection than I thought, which makes sense. I mean, it's a lot easier just to do nothing than it is to do something. So the issue is this servicer transition is supposed to happen December 14th, 2020. So what's going to happen October the 30th of 2020? We'll get there in a second. But let's talk about the existing servicers for a second. The big four, FedLoan, Navient, Nelnet, and Great Lakes. So Nelnet and Great Lakes are actually one umbrella organization. They're sort of owned by one entity. So Nelnet, Great Lakes, you could kind of throw them in together. Great Lakes has the best servicer scores. At about last time we checked, we surveyed everybody. Great Lakes got around 3.8 stars out of 5. That was the highest rating. You would definitely not eat at a restaurant that had a 3.8 out of 5 star rating. You'd be like, oh, heck no. I'm going to come back later. No thanks, Taco Bell. I'm just, again, sorry for hating on Taco Bell. I know some people love it. I loved it in college. Now I can pay $2 for my burritos and I'm able to get twice the quality. So for Great Lakes, they are the best rated of a bad group. And then you have Nelnet comes in second place around 3.3 out of 5 stars. So like the barely edible of restaurants. And then you have FedLoan and Navient, which are our readers scored them in the 2.8, 2.7 out of 5 star range for customer satisfaction. So that's like the I found a hair in my sandwich kind of rating for the Google reviews if you're talking about restaurants. Pretty much if you're going to look at those four servicers, the rational thing to do would be to say, okay, we're going to keep Great Lakes because out of the four that we've hired, they're the only one that did well enough to be acceptable. So we'll keep Great Lakes. The other three we're gonna think on. So Nelnet and Great Lakes are kind of somewhat of a package deal in some regards because Great Lakes is owned by Nelnet now. But I think what you could probably do is this is kind of what I would do. I would kind of make it a Hunger Games, so to speak, and see who's the hungriest. So I would say, okay, Navient, Nelnet, FedLoan, we're going to take advantage of our 6-month extension of your servicing contract. So we're going to extend you all for 6 months. The bottom performer for complaints and servicer issues and problems, the bottom performer after that first 6 month extension is going to get fired. And then the remaining two, the worst performer out of the second 6 months, we're going to fire that servicer next. So then that would give a massive incentive for the servicers to show once and for all who can really, when they're forced to, who can improve and who can't. And then you take the top two servicers, which have the capacity, the infrastructure, the employee headcount, the systems in place to at least keep the student loan system going in a manner that's recognizable. And then you consider hiring a couple new companies to try to replace the bottom performers. That's what I would do if I had to hire new student loan servicers is if you throw the baby out with the bathwater, this is a major system you're talking about. You're going to have a lot of problems. So why am I spooked a little bit with this? The thing is the stimulus bill, the CARES Act, causes your payments to be zero and your interest to be zero until September the 30th. And the way all the servicers have set this up is they are collecting payments starting October the 30th, which is 1 month after September 30th. The thing that's going to happen is the CARES Act requires them by law to send out 6 separate communications with borrowers starting in the beginning of August. That's when they're required to start trying to contact you 6 separate times to tell you that your payment is starting again. That is a mammoth task in and of itself, because remember what I said, it's a lot easier apparently to stop payments and interest than it is to start it and get the payment correctly debited and correctly calculated. So all these servicers have to do all this work, and this payment gets deducted October the 30th. 6 weeks later, once they've started payment collections, they'll take the first payment October 30th, they'll take the second payment November 30th, and then all of the servicing transitions over December the 14th, and you get all these servicers that don't know what the heck is going on compared to the big four. Suddenly, you have these five new servicers, which collectively today, I think, service maybe at most 5 million people, suddenly get 44 million accounts and, hey, go collect everything and go calculate all this the right way. Oh, and by the way, we have 5 million accounts at Fed Loan Servicing that are being reviewed for PSLF, and we don't know what the status is with that. Oh, and they transferred over from Great Lakes, which now also no longer exists. So good luck. That's what I'm afraid of, is that this servicer transition is just going to be very poorly handled. Because again, if you're getting fired, what incentive do you have to give a you know what? If your boss comes in and says, hey, guess what? We've paid you for 10 years in this 10-year contract, but guess what? We want you to do a bleep ton of work. And and by the way, we're going to end your contract 6 weeks later. What you would do, you'd say, okay, boss, whatever. And you'd kick your feet up. You'd flip on the Last Dance whenever that comes out on Netflix. Maybe you'd watch a little bit of Eurovision with Will Ferrell, blast some Spotify, listen to some Bill Simmons podcast, you know, and cry about the NBA maybe not coming back with how bad Corona looks like it is right now. Who knows? I'm recording this in the beginning of July. So that's what you do instead. You sure as heck wouldn't worry about doing a lot of work. And that's what could happen very easily with all these servicers, is if there's no carrot, why do you give a you know what? Why do you care? So all these new servicers are just going to kind of do maybe kind of a half-baked job, and then they'll turn it over to these new servicers who are way too small. And I looked at all these new servicers, by the way. If they are supposed to take over a servicing December the 14th, then they better start hiring like freaking right now, because they don't have butts in the chair to do the job. You'll have massive wait times, and people already don't know what the heck they're talking about after years worth of doing their servicing jobs, because they probably pay very low. So you're going to have new companies that are going to pay very low without any of that institutional knowledge. And heck, man, I wouldn't be surprised if I get emails from listeners and readers telling me that, like, they talked to their servicer and they told them, like, Repay was an exotic form of rattlesnake or something. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to hear some wild stuff is what I'm thinking of just how incompetent the new people are probably going to be, just based off of the lack of experience that they have. So I just think that the smartest thing, if Secretary DeVos has to do this, if there's no convincing her otherwise, then I think the smartest thing for her to do would be to extend that CARES student loan relief at least another 3 to 6 months. And if you do that, then at least your payments and interest are zero. You can transfer everything over to the new servicers December the 14th. If you want to be an ass, then you can send all of the bills out basically December 30th from the new servicers. I'm joking a little bit. I think reality, what would happen is, if you wanted to have the best bang for your buck, probably what you would do, and also you want to influence policy, because let's say you're projecting you're going to lose the election, then what you would do is you would extend the CARES Act from September 30th to December 31st. The first payment would be deducted January the 31st, 30 days later, just like the CARES Act is now. So that way you get notified that payments are starting again, but the payment isn't due over the Christmas holidays and the holiday season. That way people can still go out and spend money, go into further credit card debt to stimulate the moribund economy, right? You know, if you lose the election, what do you care? But so that would be what you do. That way you force payments to start again, because that's, I think, definitely a little bit of a concern, which is why Republicans are not supporting the HEROES Act. One of many reasons, I think, because you're extending student loan interest freeze and payment freeze to September 2021 in the HEROES Act. I got some unfortunate news. If you extended it that long, people that have not needed to make a student loan payment in a year and a half will have already adapted their budget to that new reality that they're feeling of no student loan payments. And you're going to have, you think default is a problem now. If you extended payment and interest freeze that long, you'd have an unbelievable default problem when you ended that forbearance. So there's no like easy answer to all this. Obviously, it's real easy for me to sit on my soapbox and throw stones, right? Because I'm not in the arena, so to speak, making the policy. But I hope that maybe somebody that's involved with this at least hears some of this. Because it's just, if you're not thinking about these problems, there's going to be all kinds of problems with this. we'll see. It certainly feels like if you're going to move forward with this service or changeover to avoid just absolute, utter, disastrous chaos, I feel like you have to extend the student loan interest freeze, payment freeze. And if you don't, oh my gosh, it's going to be like taking a freight train and trying to move it. Well, it's really more like an Amtrak train because it's a government program, right? So you've got your Amtrak train and you've got to move the Amtrak train to a new rail line going at 80 miles an hour because you're starting up all the payments. People's incomes are totally different because we have the worst economic recessions since the financial crisis. So a lot of people are going to be eligible to recalculate their income-based payment to a lower number because they've lost their jobs or their incomes have fallen. So now you have all these servicers that have to recalculate incomes based off of now millions of income changes and process call volumes for millions of borrowers that have their incomes fall and change. So you're going to need massive bodies in seats to do this. And now you're going to tell me that a bunch of like no-name companies that have no employees basically compared to the big four are going to be able to process all of this with all this massive changeover that's happening. I mean, I will be stunned. I will be stunned. I mean, one of our team members like sent this message to me and she was just like, well, does this mean job security? Like, haha. I mean, it was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment, but it's kind of like, man. And you say that student loan advice is supposed to be free and you say you don't need to pay for help managing student loans. I mean, this is kind of one of the reasons why like so many people reach out to us is because of junk like this. You're going to take at least one servicer that's competent. You're going to fire everybody, start over with companies that are way smaller and probably politically motivated in terms of the selection. And here's what's all even just cherry on top of all this stuff. Say Biden wins. Some of these companies, I think, if I look up Navient headquarters, let's see where that one is. That one's in Wilmington, Delaware. Joe Biden is the ultimate Delaware guy. So if your headquarters is in Wilmington, Delaware, and the other Fed loan, I think FIA is in Pennsylvania, which didn't he grow up in Scranton or something? So like the existing student loan servicer group is a lot more, I would say, aligned geographically with Joe Biden than these new servicers that are more geographically aligned with the Republican Party, maybe. I'm not saying they're Republicans. That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying geographically, they're in these power centers for Republicans. Since the old servicers are in the power centers for Democrats, like if I was hypothetically one of these FIA or Navient execs, I would just donate a lot of money to the Biden campaign. I would file all of the lawsuits I possibly could, which seems like Nelnet might be maybe starting to do that. And I would just try to gum up this change in the court system as long as possible, in hopes that Biden wins election, and then I could just appeal to the new administration, make an argument to congressional Democrats that this is such a power grab for them to try to push through the servicing change when they're not the ones that wanted it to happen. Then your servicer might not even change, which is all the craziness with all of this. So it's just a bunch of chaos and a bunch of mess in student loan world, I guess. You know, yippee-ki-yay or whatever Bruce Willis says in that movie, right? At least we have something to talk about because, you know, there's not as much to talk about when your payments and interest are zero, right? LOL. But this is just a big, I would call this like an unforced error. This is like when you score a goal in your own net or something like that. I mean, there's just no reason to do all this change in the middle of all this chaos already that we're experiencing with the economy. What does all this mean for you? If these servicers do change, then this is what studentaid.gov says to expect. So they say, first, you're going to get an email or letter from your servicer to inform you about the transfer. So if you're like me and you don't read your email, except for like, I read my business email every day, but my personal email, I maybe read that like once every couple weeks. Good luck looking out for that, but you get an email or a letter from your servicer to tell you that there's going to be a transfer of your loans. Then you're going to get a welcome letter from the new servicer after the new servicer receives your loans. This is going to give you the new servicer's contact info and tell you of any actions that you might need to take. This is according to studentaid.gov, by the way. All of your loan information will be transferred over from your assigned servicer to your new servicer. And you may be able to see online information that covers the period since your new servicer took your loans over. So theoretically, there will be no change in the terms of your loans. That's supposed to be accurate. Your previous servicer or the new loan servicer, they say, will work together to make sure that all payments you made during the transfer process are credited to your loan account with the new servicer. This is where I call BS. This is not how it works. You send in your PSLF form. And Nelnet transfers it to FedLoan, and FedLoan's like, you had payment credit for Nelnet? Like, I don't know. I don't see any credit. And Nelnet says, hey, your loans aren't our problem anymore, buddy. Go call FedLoan. Maybe they know. And then you go back and forth. I mean, ridiculous. Then you have to go complain to the CFPB or your congressperson or your senator to send in the employment certification forms to get those basically manually reviewed, because the old servicer doesn't give a you know what, because the old servicer only gets paid from you if your account's currently with them. That's why I've heard a lot of advice over the years from servicers that say, you don't need to send in your PSLF form until you've already done 5 years worth of PSLF credit. Well, you know why they do that? It's because they get a monthly or a yearly fee from your account being with them. And so if they had all of their reps telling the people to send in PSLF forms so that the loans transfer over to FedLoan Servicing, even though that's in your best interest, that would cause them to lose a lot of money. And so the management has told all these people, do not say to send in PSLF forms because the loans will transfer to FedLoan Servicing. And that's the only reason they tell you that. So it's really bad. And these servicers definitely act in their own best interest, because I've seen it many, many times. So Navient and Nelnet are both publicly traded companies. They're both for profit. They're both very large. In Nelnet's case, I believe the majority of the revenue is not student loan servicing revenue. But in terms of the not-for-profit or for-profit argument of which servicer you should have, the worst servicer, in my view, is FedLoan, because I just think they've done the poorest job for what they've been asked to do, which is to certify PSLF credit. And I believe they're not-for-profit. And so all of them are incompetent to different levels, but there's not a real correlation between not-for-profit and for-profit in terms of competency. The one thing that I'd feel fairly confident in is if you told these for-profit companies, shape your servicing up or you get fired, I think they would have more incentive to do that than some of the not-for-profit companies. But I don't know. I mean, this is just going to be so weird. Here's one thing that I know. So if I were you, I would go into studentaid.gov and log on, and I would hover over your name in the top, and you'll see a thing that says My Aid. You kind of hover over that, and then you can select View Details. After you click on View Details, there's this thing that says Download My Aid Data. So you click on that, that's going to give you a TXT file. So that's the master file that is basically kept in the centralized database that shows everything that's ever happened to your student loans. And so what we're suggesting is, if you're going for the PSLF program, send in your PSLF form basically at the end of October or early November to get your certified months of credit to be as close as possible to what you actually have for when your loans transfer over. Because then your PSLF credit that's listed in that TXT form is going to be what the new servicer is going to get. And there's a lesser chance you'll have to fight them to get that credit for PSLF to be accurate. Okay, so that's one thing that we're suggesting for PSLF borrowers. For everybody in general, what I would do is go to anything that shows your payment history, and I would just take a picture of it. So on my phone, when I take a picture, my picture is saved to my Google Cloud automatically. So maybe you have an iPhone, you have an iCloud or something. Most people have something that syncs to the cloud with their phone pictures that they take. So take a couple pictures of everything that you can see on your current account. Just, you don't have to save them in a special folder. Just remember that they're on your cloud if you ever needed them. And just take a series of them together. So when you're scrolling through a huge number of pictures like I do sometimes, like you'll see like, oh, there's 30 pictures I took of a bunch of different things just in case I need it. So I would do that. That probably takes you a couple minutes. Sending in your PSLF form might take you 15, 20 minutes when you do that if you're going for PSLF. And that's all you have to do in terms of worry. I mean, you have to get the right loan plan in place. And for our clients that have done that with us, I'm not worried about this servicer switch at all. I think it's going to be a pain in the ass. I think it's going to be annoying. I think it's going to take unnecessary time. But that's something that is survivable and you can deal with it. If you have a lot of complicated stuff happening, if you have a complex situation, your situation's changed and you already have hired us, we're available for follow-up consults. Just reach out to us if you're an existing client that needs a follow-up consult when this dust either starts or settles. And then if you haven't hired us already, this is kind of why I think people hire us, is because of junk like this, where you have servicers fired and new ones that are probably not capable to do the job rehired. And then there's lawsuits over the old servicers wanting to continue on, and then it goes to the courts, and like, what does this mean for my student loan plan? It's definitely going to raise people's anxiety level, but you shouldn't let it raise your anxiety level, particularly if you're listening to a podcast like this, because you're already in the top 1% of most informed people out there if you're listening to this podcast. So deep breaths. This is something, again, that is not nearly as big of a deal as a lot of things in the world, obviously, right now. But it is still pretty interesting for the niche of the student loan world, and it is kind of nutso and just totally out of left field. I was not expecting this. So again, everything in this podcast was my opinion. So if anybody wants to come after me, again, this is all my opinion about all these changes and what it means. And so if you want to reach out, hit us up. We love hearing from listeners. We want to hear what your ideas are for podcast shows, for ideas, things you want to hear about. Also, remember to ask questions. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Ask questions for the show. We would love to answer those questions. And just stay calm throughout all this. I imagine there's going to be a lot of news around student loans in the coming months ahead. Probably a new stimulus bill that we'll follow and publish something on. There will probably be a lot of chaos whenever the interest freeze and payment freeze does end. And it will end, make no mistake, it will end at some point. And then there will likely be further chaos and confusion and things for us to write about and help you about when either Trump or Biden win the election and try to do a overhaul of the Higher Education Act, which is long overdue. It's supposed to happen every 10 years. I think we're going on like, I don't even know, like 13 years now. So that's probably going to happen after the election, and we'll follow that closely and try to be an advocate for you throughout that process. Thank you so much to everybody that refinances through our links, gets cash bonuses right now on private student loans. That certainly helps support our business. When you hire us to make plans, we have over 500 reviews now. You can check me on that, studentloanplanner.com/rev. You can kind of check out all of our reviews. And our average rating is 4.96 out of 5 stars. I can't cook to save my life, but if we were a restaurant, we would be like serving filet mignon for like $5, because that's the only way I can think of that you'd have a restaurant that has a 4.96. Honestly, if we were a restaurant, there's no way we'd get a 4.96, because like restaurants, I mean, that's just really hard. Like, you can have the best restaurant in the world and it's like a 4.7, right? People are hard to please. But I'm really proud of that score. It's a testament to all of everyone on our team, how hard we work for you, how hard we work to get information out for you, how hard we try to always make things right if we ever mess something up, because we're human too, but we always try to be the best in the world at one thing, which is student loans. And if you're the best in the world at one specific thing, then you're going to add a lot of value in a world where it's so chaotic. No big company wants to be in this space, because obviously as what we've seen with the CARES Act, this stuff could go away tomorrow with the stroke of a legislative pen. But until it does, it's going to cause a lot of anxiety and a lot of problems and a lot of mental health challenges. And we want to be going back to my earlier example of the Gladiator 2, like a really awful Gladiator 2 reboot. We want to be what is that guy's name? Maximus, the Gladiator. We want to take that sword and cut through all this anxiety and mental health problems that student loans cause. We want to slice through that thing like Maximus sliced through all the bad guys in Gladiator, or Russell Crowe, right? Just as Russell Crowe slays evil Romans, we want to slay your student loan anxiety. I'm the king of really weird, corny jokes today for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful week.